Craig Bennett elevates showbiz news and views to an elegant art form, making it fun, fabulous, and kind.
Hello, Marion.
That's why so many stars love talking to him.
I'm married.
He's been doing it in all media.
It's very hard to live with that kind of scrutiny.
For all his life.
That's what I want.
Thank you, Harry.
He'd never seen such unprofessional
behavior. I was just so happy if I would remember my lines.
Oh, you ready?
And he's enjoying it now more than ever.
Ian Horner has been a reporter and a producer in TV news and talk
shows.
Sorry
about the late start.
And an interviewer and movie critic on radio. And a writer and editor in newspapers and magazines. You get the drift, not much he hasn't done. He's always reviewed movies, his first love.
Hi, I'm Maurice Holland.
But I didn't come here to be a demo singer for Celine Dion.
Thank you, Ian.
And is on first name terms with so many people that he's interviewed.
Ian.
Hello, Ian. It's Alan Carr here.
Ian.
Please come backstage and sit and let's have a glass of wine.
Do it, baby!
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, darling.
Hi, Craig. Welcome to the podcast.
Ian, it is fabulous to be with you, and I feel as though I should be here with a flute of champagne or something lovely like that for our little inaugural shenanigans. But alas, I'm not. Look at that. There's proof, just water.
You know, we could have called it the presenter and the producer. Or maybe cheese and chalk. You know, there's so much I can learn from you, from your presenting skills. I think you're brilliant, mate. And it's great to work with you.
Lovely to be here. Lovely to be alive. Lovely to have put the feet on the floor this morning.
Fantastic. Look, today's guest is Stephen Kayak. He's the director of the terrific Rock Hudson documentary. And Stephen explains not only did Hudson have two lives, but his so-called secret life wasn't at all sneaking around in the shadows. And he shows us some of the most amazing clips from Rock Hudson movies, which honestly are quite openly calling him out for being gay.
Wow. I know. I've got to be honest. I've had a sneak peek of this, Ian. And yes, those clips that you've put together from the documentary are really quite telling. It was almost like, it was a wink, wasn't it? It was kind of like a nudge to where Rock Hudson's private life was versus where his public persona was. But it was interesting also to hear the director saying he wasn't kind of torn up over all of this, you know, that he lived a private life that was a very busy private life, all sorts of fabulous, outrageous pool parties with all sorts of very handsome gentlemen in attendance. And then there was the public Rock Hudson, of course, his marriage to Phyllis Gates and, you know, the way he would date sort of beautiful Hollywood starlets, which were all cooked up by the studio publicity departments. But it was interesting to hear from Stephen that Rock Hudson had really a most terrific private life because it was completely separate to the public image. I loved your interview chat, I must say.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to that later on in this episode. And look, I see Carlotta has just announced some more shows that she's doing, including one with you. Tell us about it.
Oh, yes, the fabulous Carlotta. I can remember a couple of years ago, I did a story about Carlotta for Woman's Day. I think she was turning 78 or something, and it was just a celebration of her fabulousness. And she said, I'm going to retire, hanging up the feathers and the microphone and the showgirl stuff. And then she told me she got horribly bored, so she very quickly unretired, and she's been as busy as can be. So she's in Sydney as we speak, Australia, for those tuning in from around the world. And then in March, she and I are taking our fabulous show on tour. I got to be honest, I can't wait. She's been a dear, long, long time friend. She's a very special person, immeasurably talented, 80 years young. She's making some fabulous costumes for me. We'll be singing, or she'll be singing. I think I'll be paying an homage to Florence Foster Jenkins because I sound like an old cane toad when I open my mouth to sing. We'll be telling outrageous stories, and it'll travel around the clubs right around Australia. And look, let's face it, if there's demand, we'll travel internationally. We'll travel intergalactically. Carlotta and I are two people that will go absolutely everywhere, from the emptying of an ashtray to the opening of a fridge door to, you know, on the Concorde if they were still flying it.
Hey, Craig, here's a question without notice. When I interviewed Carlotta for the TV version of her life, I got to say, I found her a bit guarded, as though she was a bit wary of the press. Now, you've got on really well with her for so long. What's made her so reserved, and how did you get her trust?
Look, I think the thing about Carlotta is she's a showgirl. For those who don't know, she was one of the original showgirls at Sydney's Lay Girls when King's Cross was fabulous and it was like the entertainment centre of, well, really Australia in many regards. But I think that she's so used to being a performer to all of a sudden then have people asking you questions about your private life or your professional life. Some people take to that like a duck to water. Others don't. She knows she can trust me because she knows where I live. And if I ever did a wrong, I could wind up maybe a bit like what befell Juanita Nielsen, you know. I don't think I'd be that comfortable under the third runway of Sydney Airport. So I'm quite happy to just play it perfectly and to let Carlotta razzle, dazzle and shine and shimmer wherever I'm interviewing her and not put her in an awkward situation. I think she probably has been burnt in the past. We've never really talked about it, but I can imagine maybe she's been burned and she is a little guarded with people that she doesn't know. But heck with me, gosh, we've talked about some of her famous lovers, including now a late great Australian current affairs king, whose name shall remain and kind of nameless at this point in time. MW were his initials. But she said he was just.
You're
the
not
most...
talking about Mike Willis here, are you?
Oh, I couldn't possibly. You said it, I didn't. But
there
she
is, of
said
course,
he was...
Mike Walsh.
No, current affairs host.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Definitely Mike Willacy, and she said that he was just the most amazing, amazing lover. So many others. Gee whiz, John Bonham. And she thought that John Bonham, you know, the great rocker, had kind of hopped into bed thinking it was somebody else. Anyway, look, that's Carlotta's business to talk all about that, but she is quite wonderful. I'm looking forward to our shows, and I love her as a dear friend, and I just know I've said far too much.
Okay, what a Craig's classic.
Can we edit that out? Bang, yep. Bang, bang, like that? No, we can't. That's the problem when we're live like this.
Okay, what are Craig's classics that you've got lined up for us later?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm going to be talking about Witness for the Prosecution. See, I'm a sucker for those fabulous old movies, the classics, the campy celluloid extravaganzas, those disaster movies of the 70s. These are my guilty pleasures. And so we thought, why not dive into the vault, have a bit of a rustle around each episode, and I'll give you my recommendations, because there is nothing better, I think, Ian, than hopping on the couch, maybe with a glass of something cold and cheeky or red and warming. Some people might take a tub of ice cream with them or a big block of chocolate, and then just pushing play on some fabulous DVD. And that, to me, is a fabulous Friday night or Saturday night at home at the movie. So Witness for the Prosecution. And then I mentioned those fabulous disaster epics of the 70s. One of my all-time favourite guilty pleasures is Earthquake, with one of those all-star casts, including Walter Matthau. And he, of course, didn't go by the name of Walter Matthau. I'll put my teeth in a minute. I'll tell you all about that when we get to talking about those wonderful, fabulous cult movies and bona fide celluloid classics.
I'm going to talk about Scorsese and DiCaprio's latest joint venture, Killers of the Flower Moon.
Dying to see it.
It's one of the longest films ever made, which Hitchcock would hate. We'll take a look at Sigourney Weaver's show, which she shot in Australia. We've got a bonus audio clip of Matthew Perry reading from his stunning autobiography. I've got to say, this is one of the best and most moving and funny, tragic life stories I've ever read.
Me too. I've read it 400 pages, and it really, truly is from the heart, isn't it? But it's funny, it's tragic, it's sad. It's made all the more compelling by the fact that he's no longer with us. He's been gathered, and we still don't know exactly why. But what a story, how brave he was to tell it in the way in which he did.
Okay, this is what we've been waiting for. It's time for Craig's News and Gossip.
I'm going to tell you an incredible story. This is the hottest story since the Chicago fire.
Surely you can't be serious.
This is the greatest yarn in journalism since Livingston discovered Stanley.
I am serious.
Walter, I got the story. It's a pip, and I got it exclusive.
And don't call me Shirley.
We got the biggest story in years.
What a story!
Craig's News and Gossip.
So it's gossip time. You know, for years there's been talk of bringing the life and times, the incredible career of the late, great Dean Martin to the big screen, a la Elton John in Rocket Man. And of course, there was Freddie Mercury and Bohemian Rhapsody. There was Baz Luhrmann's Elvis biopic. And I think the Respect one about Aretha Franklin, right? Well, you think about Dean Martin. It was Elvis Presley who dubbed him the King of Cool. He and Jerry Lewis, of course, one of the most famous comedy teams of all time. So it's interesting, Ian, because Martin Scorsese had long talked about doing a Dean Martin biopic. It was to be called Dino. It was Tom Hanks who was in the running to channel, I suppose, Dean Martin, the fabulous Valare singer's life. So many wonderful songs. Well, I can give you this little bit of scoopola, because I spoke with Dina Martin, Dean's daughter, on my Celebrity Drop YouTube channel. That's where I talk to all sorts of fabulous showbiz people. And Dina, well, she told me that she's working on a movie about her father, but there is one great big speed hump. Take a look at what Dina had to say. Where are things at with a movie on your father? It's screaming to be done.
It really is. My main problem is who could play him? And I, you know, I'm still thinking, you know, with Joe Mantegna, he wants to do, when my book came out, he called me, he said, Dina, I have to direct it. I said, what, direct what? He said, the movie, we've got to make a movie, I have to direct it. I said, you want to play Dean Martin? He said, no, I want to direct it. So we're still, you know, working on that, you know, and Joe is a very good friend, you know, of ours. And it just has to be right. The script has to be perfect because my dad deserves that. And, you know, so we're still working on something like that. As far as Scorsese, and I don't know what they're doing, but we'd have to find the perfect Dean Martin.
Now, another gossip item. This could be thrilling news, and I mean this, for fans of Jack Nicholson's, if it happens, because director James L. Brooks, you would know him. He's made a whole bunch of fabulous movies. He and Jack are very great chums. In fact, he's directed Jack Nicholson in four movies. There was Broadcast News, there was Terms of Endearment, Rattle Ahead, Craig, yes, As Good as It Gets. And the last movie that Jack Nicholson made, which was back in 2010, and that was How Do You Know? He didn't have a big role in that, so maybe there's a lot of people who've not heard of that. Anyway, that was 13 years ago since that came out, as I say, 2010. Jack has done nothing new on the big screen. But you know what? He said himself he's kind of done with it. 65 years, a star. He's made something like 64 movies. Of course, there's three Academy Awards. He's 86. He's basically retired, says love reading books under trees and sitting up all night watching sport, not having to worry about your figure or being a movie star. Anyway, James L. Brooks is on a mission, you see. As I say, four movies he's made with Jack Nicholson, would like to make another one. So his mission is this, to bring Jack Nicholson back to the big screen one last time. Ever since, of course, Jack Nicholson has retired, the tabloids have been whipped into a froth claiming that there's health problems or that maybe his memory is failing him and this is why he's decided to retire. Well, James L. Brooks says absolutely not true at all. Jack Nicholson is just loving his life away from the spotlight. He certainly is in no decline. He's hale and fabulous and wonderful, and you often see him at the Lakers games in Los Angeles. Anyway, look, as Kath from Kath and Kim fame was very fond of saying, fingers and toes, fingers and toes. If you're a great Jack Nicholson fan, join in me. I'm not going to show you my toes crossed, but they are. But my fingers are certainly crossed. It would be wonderful to see him back maybe just one more time.
You make me want to be a better man.
That's maybe the best compliment of my life.
It would be wonderful to see him back maybe just one more time.
Yes, it certainly would. Okay, let's go to the movies.
How about a movie?
Let's all go to the movie.
Let's go to the movie.
Killers of the Flower Moon is a long film, but it sure is worth it. It's 3 hours and 26 minutes, which reminds me of Hitchcock's rule that a film should only ever be as long as the endurance of the human bladder. There was one guy at my screening who snuck out no less than three times during the film, presumably to go to the toilet. And then when I finally got to the loo at the end of it, there he was standing next to me. Poor guy. It begins with the discovery of oil in 1920s in Oklahoma on Indian land. Leonardo DiCaprio is a war veteran at a loose end who turns up at his uncle's place. His uncle, Robert De Niro, accepts him with open arms and calmly takes over his life, unbelievably involving him in a string of murders. De Niro is a powerful white man trying to get his hands on Indian land and Indian oil. Here's De Niro ripping into DiCaprio because the murder he was supposed to arrange didn't go quite right.
This supposed to be a suicide, you dumbbell. You didn't tell him to leave the gun.
I don't know why I told him to leave the gun. I told him to leave the gun.
Just like you told him, kid. I don't know why he didn't. I don't know why.
I told him just like you told him. You told him to do it in the front of the head, and why didn't do it in the back of the head?
It's so simple. The front is the front. The back is the back.
He has to make it look like he done it himself.
It just looks like murder. It's not supposed to be that way. You hear?
I told him the front of the head. I said, the front of the head, just like this, just like you told me. I promise you, I swear on my children.
No, I swear on my children, King.
Settle.
And don't swear on your children. It makes you look foolish.
What do they say? When you want a job done right. The acting is terrific, just as you'd expect. De Niro is measured, calm, seemingly so civilized. You know, if he told me I had to kill my wife, I'd believe him. DiCaprio plays it like a little boy. One of his interesting acting choices is he's twisted his mouth and he's set it into a frozen scowl, which must be hard to maintain for the whole film. Once or twice he actually forgets. It makes him look a bit like a petulant teenager, but that's ultimately his saving grace. He's never completely on side with his uncle, and that leads him to find his own integrity. It was made by Apple Plus, and it's all ready to hit the streaming service as we speak. You'll be able to hit pause for a toilet break whenever you want. The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart is a mini-series based on a book by Australian writer Holly Ringland. It stars Sigourney Weaver, who came to Australia to make it. It's about 9-year-old Alice, who loses her parents in a house fire, and Grandma takes her in. Grandma lives on a rural property where she grows flowers, which become symbols of beauty that's easily crushed and have to be nurtured to grow into something strong and magnificent. Ali Brown is amazing as young Alice in the first few episodes. Grandma is played by Sigourney Weaver, last seen on Doc Martin. She's a forbidding woman here, apparently with her own secrets, and she's committed to doing the best for Alice and the other women seeking refuge on her property. Here in this scene, a young woman has escaped to the flower farm and she's telling her story, spurring Grandma into action. Now, up to this point, Weaver's character has been pretty contained, but that is about to change.
There are wedding rings from the night he beat me and I lost the baby. His and the one he cut off my fucking finger. He said you'd keep me safe.
I will.
I'm gonna find this fucker and get rid of him.
Go, Siggy. Where have we seen her get all fired up like that before?
Get away from her, you bitch!
Isn't she great? She could make a career out of this. Leah Purcell is terrific, so is co-star Asha Keddie. The camera work is spectacular, reminding me of Yellowstone, where the scenery was just a work of art in the background. Much of this was shot on location in country New South Wales. The photography is really marvellous, as I said. It's on Prime Video. You gotta love Sigourney in full flight. What do you reckon?
Oh, I think she's absolutely fabulous. I remember her back in the days of Gorilla and the Mist as Diane Fossey going, get away from my gorillas. She gives it, doesn't
That's
she?
That's fantastic. I just love this book by Matthew Perry. Talk about honesty. It's got the trips to the hospital at all hours, hiding his addictions from the cameras, the solidarity of support from his co-stars, stealing meds from the bathrooms of friends that he was visiting, short-circuiting all his relationships, including Julia Roberts. Despite all this, there's this completely disarming humour. You just love the guy, all the while he's working overtime to destroy himself. He's so vulnerable, and it's like he's determined to land the first punch.
You know, I think it's been made all the more poignant since his death last October, 400 pages of soul-bearing. But I've also got to say, as you indicated there, there's some fabulous flashes of humour through it all as well. I've been asked many times as to maybe why Matthew Perry wrote this. Did he need to write it? Well, I mean, certainly he didn't need the money. Do you know, I think it's this, Ian, so much has been written and regaled about Matthew Perry's life. Some of it true, maybe a lot of it not true. Some of it hugely distorted. Some of it almost maybe kind of there, but not quite landing. And I think he probably felt, you know, why not set the record straight? Why not just get the real Matthew Perry story out there, which I've got to say is more staggering than anything the tabloids could have and did make up over the years. You think about those rehab trips. You think about the fact it cost him almost by his own account $9 million to finally get sober. You think about the extraordinary journey that his life took. And, you know, as they often say, you couldn't make it up. Well, he didn't make it up. He lived it. I just think he wanted to tell his truth in his own words, with his own heart, with his own spirit.
I think you're right. He did want to set the record straight. But I also got the sense that he was really writing it to himself. He was trying to process all of these things that had happened. And he wanted to get it straight in his own mind to follow where he'd been, where he was going to, and hopefully what was going to happen in the rest of his life. It seemed to me a great exercise in speaking to himself and putting context and imposing some sort of order on what had been a dreadful mess up to that point. Anyway, let's hear from Matthew himself, reading from his book. And no apologies for the opening sentences, as bitterly ironic as they are.
Hi, my name is Matthew, although you may know me by another name. My friends call me Matty, and I should be dead. If you like, you can consider what you're about to hear to be a message from the beyond. It's day 7 of the pain. And it may be day 7 of the pain, but it was also day 10 of no movement, if you catch my drift. I hadn't taken a shit in 10 days. There's the drift. Something was wrong, very wrong. This was a different kind of pain, like my body was gonna burst. This was the no fucking around kind of pain. At 49, I was still afraid to be alone. Left alone, my crazy brain, crazy only in this area, by the way, would find some excuse to do the unthinkable, drink and drugs. I have no fear of talking in front of 20,000 people, but put me alone on my couch in front of the TV for the night, and I get scared. And that fear is of my own mind, fear of my own thoughts. Fear that my mind will urge me to turn to drugs as it has so many times before. My mind is out to kill me. I am constantly filled with a lurking loneliness, a yearning, clinging to the notion that something outside of me will fix me. But I had had all that the outside had to offer. Julia Roberts is my girlfriend. It doesn't matter, you have to drink. I just bought my dream house. It looks across the whole city. Can't enjoy that without a drug dealer. I'm making $1 million a week. I win, right? Would you like to have a drink? Why, yes, I would. Thank you very much. Please don't misunderstand me. All of those things, Julia and the dream house and $1 million a week, were wonderful, and I will be eternally grateful for all of them. They just weren't the answer. If I had to do it all over again, would I still audition for Friends? You bet your ass I would. Would I drink again? You bet your ass I would. If I didn't have alcohol to soothe my nerves and help me have fun, I would have leaped off a tall building sometime in my 20s. I don't write all of this so anyone will feel sorry for me. I write these words because they're true. I write them because someone else may be confused by the fact that they know they should stop drinking. Like me, they have all the information and they understand the consequences, but they can't stop drinking. You're not alone, my brothers and sisters. In the dictionary, under the word addict, there should be a picture of me looking around very confused.
Having just read the book, news of his death was an absolute kick in the guts. You have to read it to get that. Who was your favourite friend on the show, Craig?
I'm going to be totally candid here, Ian. Friends did nothing for me. It didn't flop my mop. It didn't pepper my snapper. Didn't coconut my Lamington. I couldn't give a continental about Friends. However, I respect all of the stars and the writers. It was a 10-year phenomenon, still absolutely adored. And then you look at people like Jennifer Aniston, of course, who, in the morning show, or in Australia it's called The Morning Wars, is absolutely incredible. I can now see why she kind of became that breakout star on that show, because there is something so charismatic about Jennifer. Likewise, there was about Matthew Perry and David Schwimmer and Lisa Kudrow and all of the rest of the gang. But nah, look, it didn't kind of do it for me. I bet it jumped your jacks, though.
Yeah, look, fair enough, mate. For me, it was Phoebe. She was just remarkable. I loved her. Chandler, a very close second. But the joy of the show to me was getting six characters with six strong personalities to play six well-defined people and to give them equal screen time in each episode. I thought that was amazing. Real tribute to the guys who ended up doing Grace and Frankie. That's a story for another day.
What has or is about to happen?
What is he talking about?
You complete me.
Is it over or is it just beginning?
You had me at hello.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Fasten your seatbelts.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
It's going to be a bumpy night.
Please!
But it doesn't mean anything.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Craig's Classics.
For me, there is no better night at home than feet up on the lounge, dragging out an old DVD movie or a miniseries, pouring a glass and looking back over some fabulous, fabulous old classic. And so that's what I'm going to be bringing to you every week. You know, the bona fide classics that maybe you'd forgotten about, those campy epics, the trashy celluloid extravaganzas a la John Waters. First up, a movie that barely needs an introduction. I have it right here in my hot little hand, a great fave of mine. It's Witness for the Prosecution, which I'd say I've probably seen around about 50 times. Now, It's a Lure Never Dims. It was nominated for, I think it was 5 Academy Awards. Brilliant courtroom drama made back in 1957. Now, directed by the late, great Billy Wilder, based on Agatha Christie's smash hit play that took the world by storm. Look, a legendary story, I guess, known to many. Wealthy woman is found murdered. Tyrone Power plays her suitor. He's accused of the ghastly crime. But did he do it?
I'm not this girl. I'm his girl. Tell her, Len.
Leonard, is this the girl who was with you in the travel bureau? The girl you said you hardly knew, didn't even know her name?
There is the question. His only hope of acquittal is, in fact, the testimony of his wife, played incredibly by Marlene Dietrich. But his alibi, that seems to be airtight, is shattered into a million pieces when Marlena's character reveals some shocking secrets of her own.
You can't, Leonard. Not after what I've done. I won't let you.
Don't be silly. I saved your life getting you out of Germany. You saved mine getting me out of this mess. So we're even. It's all over now.
Don't, Leonard. Don't leave me. Don't, Leonard. Shh. Don't!
Pull yourself together. They'll have you up here for perjury. Well, don't make it worse, or they'll try you as an accessory.
Stella. Spellbinding, unmissable, and stunning entertainment. Now, my second movie is one of those celluloid guilty pleasures. Let me take you back to 1974, and it's the disaster epic Earthquake, which for me scores a 10 out of 10 on the campy movie Richter scale. Earthquake was one of those all-star movies. You know, back in the day in the 70s, we had The Towering Inferno, there was The Poseidon Adventure, and of course, then there was Earthquake. The stars, Charlton Heston, Ava Gardner. Here, I've got the DVD cover just to prove it. George Kennedy, Lorne Greene, Genevieve Bujold. That's just for starters. Now, within minutes of the opening title, we have Ava Gardner as the jealous wife faking a suicide after accusing her husband, Charlton Heston, of having a shocking affair. Charlton's chest hair gets a good big look in as he strips off to take a shower after a very energetic morning run. Looked a bit like the chest hair on Austin Powers, you know, you get the drift. So we have then George Kennedy tossed off the police force for punching out an officer who accused him of running into Zsa Zsa Gabor's hedge. As I say, this is in the first 10 minutes. Somebody drowns in the bottom of an elevator shaft. So look to the plot, 1970s Los Angeles, essentially a group of disparate characters with all the dramas of Days of Our Lives meets The Bold and the Beautiful. Look, the special effects scene are absolutely first rate. Remembering, this is 1974. There was no CGI. So all those big bits of concrete you see raining out of buildings, they're all huge bits of concrete. So the stunt people really had to be on their mark. Just some fun facts. Ava Gardner plays Lorne Greene's daughter in real life. She was only 8 years younger than Lorne Greene. An unknown Victoria principal for years, she went on to play Pam Ewing in Dallas, is wearing a very weird Afro wig. Walter Matthau, the great Walter Matthau, he stars in this movie. He plays a drunk. And if you check the credits, he doesn't go by the name of Walter Matthau. He goes by a made-up name, a surname which contains virtually every letter of the alphabet twice. He didn't get paid for the cameo. And that 12-minute earthquake sequence, when you saw it at the movies when it was originally released, of course, it was there in Sensoround, which had the theatre. You almost felt as though the whole thing was really shaking like an earthquake had struck. There you go. There are my two. A witness for the prosecution. Here it is, Exhibit A. And, of course, then Earthquake. So if you're thinking of something absolutely fabulous for the weekend, couldn't go past those two, just for starters.
I was intrigued to interview Stephen Kayak, the director of Rock Hudson, All That Heaven Allowed. You see, Stephen knows just about all there is to know about Rock Hudson. He spent several years researching him, and he's put together a really interesting, fascinating, and revealing documentary. Have a listen. G'day there.
Hello, hello.
Great to chat with you, Stephen. Rock Hudson only ever was nominated for one Academy Award, but maybe he should have won for Best Performance by an Actor Playing Straight. It was an incredible performance. I mean, off camera as well as on.
It truly was. Not the only one, but maybe one of the greatest.
When was it that he could actually let his hair down, let his guard down?
I think the second they yelled cut, to be honest with you, at home in his trailer by the pool in Palm Springs and Laguna. I mean, I feel like he lived this really rich, very sexually satisfied private life. He had surrounded himself with tons of friends, a lot of gay men who at the time were in long-term relationships, you know, and lots of lovers, and just he had a very full, rich life behind the scenes, you know, which kind of contradicts a lot of, I think, common narratives of the tortured, you know, closeted gays of the 50s and 60s, just in constant panic about being outed and raided at a gay bar. I mean, that was partly the story, but there were full, rich, sexy lives being led, you know, just like there are today. Except they were a lot more well-dressed back then, weren't they?
How devastating would it have been his career if he had come out publicly?
Oh, over, completely over. I mean, that's the thing, right? It's just, you know, he was the biggest box office draw of the mid-50s, early 60s. It would have ended immediately. I mean, people are barely ready to handle it today, you know. a straight presenting romantic slash action hero lead. You know, name one who's an out gay man, right?
Most of the actors that we know and respect for being gay and out, they began their careers being gay and out. There was never a moment where they had to come out for most.
Well, some, Sir Ian McKellen among them, you know what I mean? Like there have been great moments when people have stepped forward, but I mean, I don't think you of a level, like if we're looking for a parallel, you know, of a romantic lead of Rock Hudson's stature, I don't think anyone's risen to that level and then come out of the closet. It's not done. We have such visibility across the spectrum right now, but in those terms, I think we still have a long way to go.
It seems outrageous that so many people were blind to the fact that Rock Hudson was gay. If he lived a more or less open life privately, he was dealing and talking and meeting with lots and lots of people. And there are very few towns like Hollywood that can keep a secret. And then we had all those wonderful double entendres in his movies.
The lash for you, betrayer of women.
Why not, darling? Why not?
For a moment, I forgot what I am. You'll come?
I'd be delighted.
Why aren't you married, Jordan?
Well, we got music.
Oh, Ron, isn't it enough that we love each other?
No, Carrie. It isn't.
From now on, you're going to have a new look. No more gay married bachelor.
Line after line after line, where it was sailing so close to the bone, and they're almost calling him out for being gay.
Our marriage was a mistake, yours as well as mine.
Was it? You didn't think so when you thought I could make a gentleman out of you. Well, you married me, and you're going to stay married to me. So sneak around back alleys if that's the kind of man you are. I doubt that I could stop you.
I wonder if he's single.
I don't know how long I can get away with this act.
Why can't you get married?
It's the sort of thing a man doesn't discuss with a nice woman.
Do you love me, Mitch?
Like a brother.
I don't want you as a brother.
Can't be any other way, Mary.
Ye gods, you've got cold feet. Complains, complains.
That about does it, Commissioner.
Yeah, sure does. Thanks.
You're welcome.
See you in the shower.
Okay, baby.
What are you doing here?
Where am I?
Well, this is Jerry Webster's apartment. Me?
I can't. I'm too ashamed. Forget me, Carol. You deserve a man.
Oh, it's you. I wasn't sure.
Hiding in closets isn't going to cure you.
Literally hiding in a closet. You know what I mean? Like, it couldn't have been lost on him. Yeah, it's unbelievable that they did it to the degree that they did.
We live in a world of phantasmagoria. False forms and false faces. Each man wears a mask against his fellows. Well, if you've nothing to say.
Aye. Give me a light.
I think somehow they might have been, you know, little secret messages to the crowd that was in the know. I can't imagine being a closeted gay fan at the time watching that. You know, what must you have thought?
You're going down to town tomorrow and find yourself some gay young playmate.
I don't want to be with anybody else, I tell you.
Yes, you do.
It's about time you got hitched, isn't it?
No, I have trouble enough finding oil.
Kung Far.
I thought we could get together, have a cup of coffee, maybe, get acquainted. We might find we have a lot in common.
It's crazy. They're very funny. But, you know, it wasn't just him. That was the thing. It was the times. Everybody who was gay in that era had to live some kind of double life. it's constant code switching. You're constantly presenting one way and behaving another. You know, a lot of people just forget how dangerous and treacherous it could be. You know, in the States, legally, gay people were considered unapprehended felons. You were literally criminalized just for being gay.
You've got to tell him the truth.
Do you know what'll happen?
I know it'll mean you lose your job and your customers and everything, but you've got to do that. Once you start fooling people, you have to go on and keep on fooling them. And you're too nice a guy to be a phony and to keep on being a phony.
So at any moment, you know, your bar could be raided. You'd be arrested. Your name would be... It's like the typical story of that era. But we wanted to kind of get under that and show a little bit more of the personal, the sexual, the fun, the kind of the complexities and of that double life as it was lived very, very publicly on screen.
He wasn't the only one, of course. I mean, so many.
Oh, no.
Raymond Burr, Robert Reed, Jim Nabors, Richard Chamberlain, they could have almost formed a club.
It goes on and on and on. Yeah, I mean, you know, like his friend Anthony Perkins, who was, some of them were a lot more tortured. You know, Monty Cliff Rock doesn't seem to have a bone of angst in his body, you know. And he clearly wasn't of that school of acting, you know, that favored that, right? He wasn't a actor studio New Yorker. He was a happy-go-lucky studio creation. He learned everything about acting on the job, on the Universal lot. These are people who had real intimate, sometimes very intimate contact with Rock. But, you know, they were also changed and really deeply affected by having him in their lives.
Would we have let Rock Hudson come out as gay today?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, if only. Would he have done it? I don't really know. The speculative is very hard to contend with, especially when you're dealing with someone like that who is so invested in being closeted, right? Yeah, I don't know. Would he have joined Ian McKellen and done, you know, some campy TV and just been out and proud and finally, you know, let it all hang out? Who knows? I tend to think not, but, you know, obviously we would have welcomed him with open arms if he had.
To your knowledge, there are still actors and famous celebrities who are gay and afford to come out.
Yeah. I mean, young actors, even, you know, a very good friend of mine is a casting director. We were just chatting the other day about it. You know, he's like, there are these guys who are, you know, trying to make it a big break on TV or, you know, do more mainstreamy stuff. And they are terrified and they're still just like, nope, not doing it. Don't let them know. I'm keeping the secret. Just because they want to leg up and they want to take those roles. I mean, we still have that problem. It's crazy. It's the idea that someone could achieve that level of success that Rock Hudson did, right? And then come out. That's the thing I don't think we've seen, right? What romantic action hero type box office juggernaut has stepped out of the closet? I mean, am I missing somebody? You know what I mean? I can't think of one, really. I just can't. You know, why isn't Billy Porter like an action hero? You know, why can't actors like that have those same opportunities? Because there's still a homophobic kickback against people who are too gay, right? That's the problem. Or present as too gay. It's ridiculous. There are still barriers in place.
Is it because the studio heads don't have the balls to cast gay actors, or is it because too much money, too much of the budget of productions is governed by commercial reasons?
Both, yeah, but it's people not having the balls to do it, having the cojones to actually just stand up and say it doesn't matter, because I don't think the audiences are going to care anymore. Give me a break.
Wow, I'm picking my jaw up because that was an absolutely fabulous interview, Ian. What an interesting man Stephen Kayak is. I've seen the documentary and it was quite an eye-opener. All That Heaven Allowed, it's called, which was based on the movie that he starred in back in the 50s with Jane Wyman, All That Heaven Allows. Weren't those clips really telling, you know, the way in which it was kind of like Rock Hudson being outed. I got to wonder, do you think he knew? Do you think it was maybe some kind of in-joke? Do you think perhaps we might be reading far too much into it? I mean, you know, in a two-hour movie, you're bound to be able to pull out some kind of grab where out of context, it does give the impression. I don't know, but just all of those clips side by side through so many of those movies he did, it is kind of like maybe it was some kind of in-joke and he was having a gentle but very firm tongue-in-cheek pull of our chains. Anyway, what the heck? It was a fascinating documentary. Rock Hudson, certainly a fascinating man. And nice to know, too, according to Stephen, that he didn't live this tragic life. It was divided very separately into two parcels. You had the public Rock Hudson, which was a carefully honed image as it needed to be back then. And then you had the private Rock Hudson that was having those wild pool parties and a wonderful life, not somebody sitting there shuddering behind the Venetian blinds thinking, oh, this is all such a misery. Why can't I be the real me? Incredible. Lovely. Congratulations.
And we've got more on Rock Hudson next time. We've got a bit of a scoop. Linda Evans didn't do any press for the Hudson doco, but only months before, you did an interview with her for Studio 10. We'll have footage from that, plus her account of from the doco of that kiss that she shared with Rock Hudson on Dynasty.
Oh, yeah. Look, Linda was absolutely lovely to chat with. And we talked about that kiss, of course, because I remember at the time, and we can go into more details later, of course, but just a little tease. It's nothing like being on tenterhooks. You know, the reports of the time had Linda, you know, living in fear that she might be the next because of that Rock Hudson kiss, because they played Lovers in Dynasty. That was back in 1985. Not at all. He didn't kiss her on the lips and was very careful. In fact, she was rather offended by that because they were meant to, but he just refused. Well, of course, then when it all came out later, the other shoe dropped and she knew exactly why. Look, she was a beautiful lady to talk with. I've got to say, of all the many hundreds of interviews with Hollywood greats I've done, Linda is up there at the top of it. I also, speaking of Rock Hudson and Dynasty and that particular story arc, John James, who of course played Jeff Colby on both Dynasty and the Colbys, he was there during the making of that when Rock was there. And he told me that he sat in the same makeup chair. Rock had just gotten out. He plonked down and he looked at this old man while he was waiting to be made up. He was finishing up having been made up or being made up. And he said to the makeup person, who was that? That was Rock Hudson. What? That was Rock Hudson. Now, John James is a great lover. He comes from a showbiz family, a great lover of old Hollywood and those great old Hollywood stars. He didn't recognize Rock Hudson in a pink fit because, as we were to know, Rock Hudson was dealing with HIV and, in fact, only had months to live. So he was kind of like skin and bone and had no idea. Anyway, more of that next time, that's for sure.
Looking forward to that, mate. I'll be reviewing the season two of The Bear, which is the best cooking show you'll ever see. Also,
one of the best cooking shows.
It's tremendous. It's I'll tell you more about it next time. But it's also one of the best ever character-driven dramas that you'll ever see. It's just wonderful. Also, I'll be talking about Meryl's star turn as a guest on season three of Only Murders in the Building, and Saltburn at the cinemas. Can't wait to get stuck into that.
Now, I'm dying to see that. And I looked at the trailer the other day and thought, how intriguing is that, with Jacob Elordi is in it, the Aussie actor who went on to play Elvis Presley and is now So hot in Hollywood, you need those oven mitts to handle him with, don't you? Not that one should be handling anybody these days, but you kind of know what I mean. In Craig's Classics, I will be bringing to you one of the great John Waters movies. I alluded to John Waters a little earlier in our chat, Polyester with Divine, incredible. And then there's another movie that I guess maybe not a lot of people have heard of, or if you have, you've probably long forgotten about it, and that is Whatever Happened to Aunt Alice with the great, sadly late, Ruth Gordon. That's kind of a take on Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, but then completely out the window. It's an absolute must-see if you love those kind of really campy, completely unexpected thrillers.
So that's our pilot episode for today, some of which we had to do quite a few times. First, my mic had to be replaced, then Zoom let us down.
Lovely to chat with you, Ian. You've given away all the secrets now, including the backstage dramas of getting this to you. It's been great fun, and I look forward to chatting with you next time.
We'd love some feedback. Both of us would. Leave your comments, and we'll see you next time. Cheers.
Bye.